Hey, I'm Hannah Baba, host of Cross Currents, and just a few times a year, we come and ask you for your support. Now's the time to do that. If you want to contribute today, you can at kalw.org. It's our May membership campaign. Go to kalw.org and click donate. Thanks.
KALW.
Which media station are you from?
I'm with KALW 91.7 FM.
Oh no, we're only doing interviews with specific people that are supporting our causes.
College campus protests are turning away from traditional media and relying on student journalists from their schools.
We did a 24-hour coverage of the camp, and then of course writing the article, editing it, and going to classes.
Today, how a new generation of organizers is redefining good journalism. Then, a conversation with the author of the Healing Trauma Workbook for Asian Americans.
I have this misconception that somebody is either in the hospital, disabled, or normal, with no in between. And of course, the reality is most of us are somewhere in between.
We talked to psychologist Helen Sue, part of our AAPI Senior Mental Health Series. I'm Hannah Baba, and this is Cross Currents. We're in the middle of an international student movement right now. For more than a month, students at universities across the world have set up pro-Palestinian encampments to demand that their schools divest from companies profiting off of the war in Gaza. But it hasn't been easy. Protesters have clashed with police, university administrations, and even the media. Organizers are wary about who they'll talk to for fear of being misportrayed or even put in danger. The distrust of mainstream media has meant that student reporters have had unique and sometimes even exclusive access to encampments. KALW's Ren Farrell has been covering student encampments for weeks. I talked to him about what it's been like for him and for the student journalists. So, Ren, you've been at quite a few Bay Area encampments with your recorder and your microphone. Can you describe these encampments?
Yeah, I mean, they've all been really different, and some have actually since come down. I haven't been to every single one that's gone up in the Bay, but I've been to SF State, UC Berkeley, and UCSF, the medical school in San Francisco.
I hadn't heard of the one at a medical school. What was that one like?
It was definitely the smallest, the most short-lived of all the encampments that I went to. The first day that I was there, there were maybe 50 people and less than a dozen tents. And I think because of how small it was, the university's response was rapid and harsh. Less than 12 hours after the tents went up, the police showed up, took everybody's tent, and even arrested somebody. After the police left, organizers got together to discuss what they were going to do next, and I was there trying to record, but they actually kicked me out.
And they've been. Oh, everyone is welcome to come be part of the circle. Do we want media here while we're discussing this?
No.
Wait, I thought
can
we were.
Can you leave, please?
So, Ren, were folks this media wary at the other encampments you went to?
Yes, absolutely. And I just want to say that it makes a lot of sense to be media wary. They have to worry about being doxxed if their names and faces are out there.
Yeah.
People say they've lost their jobs for publicly expressing support for Palestine. They've received death threats. They've been attacked. It's really not a joke. And that's a big reason why people don't want to talk to, quote unquote, mainstream media. Here's another example of that from when I visited the encampment at SF State. So SF State's Gaza Solidarity Encampment went up at the end of April, and there was a lot of local media there, but getting students and organizers to talk was actually really hard. They had this sign up that said, "Man, F these Western news outlets," and then a list of outlets for people to follow, like Middle East Eye and AJ Plus, which made things a little difficult for me.
Hi, sorry, my name is Ren Farrell. I'm a reporter with KALW. I was wondering if I could ask you a few questions about...
Which media station are you from?
I'm with KALW 91.7 FM.
Oh no, we're only doing interviews with specific people that are supporting our causes. We don't want to be misconstrued.
Oh, I mean...
That's fine. Thank you.
So these encounters are a little, you know, intense. What did that mean for the coverage then?
Well, at some universities, the only people that organizers and students would talk to were student reporters because they already knew them and they already trusted them.
Right.
And so this actually meant that major outlets like CNN were relying on the work of student reporters. I actually spoke to a student reporter at SF State about her experience at the encampment.
My name is Karen Kaur. I am 27 years old. And this is my final year here at SF State.
So Karen is a staff reporter at Golden Gate Express, or GGX, which is SF State's student-run online publication. Karen's reporting especially was unique because she didn't just have access to the encampment. She actually got to camp out with the organizers, which was great for her because she lives in Sacramento. Karen told me that she was the only reporter who was allowed to pitch a tent at the SF State encampment.
Is this your tent?
Yeah, this is my tent.
You brought it from Sacramento?
Yeah, brought it from Sacramento, brought some blankets, and I brought my own sleeping bag. It's kind of a mess. Sorry.
Okay, so Ren, she had unlimited access to the encampment?
No, so even though she was allowed to camp out and people knew her and trusted her, she still didn't have full access.
There are certain discussions that were happening that would be closed off or things that would not be said in front of me, because they were private matters.
And people weren't always happy with her coverage.
There's been backlash that I've received based off of previous wording because of us following AP style.
Oh, so this is interesting because, you know, as journalists, we mostly follow AP style, which is kind of the style of the Associated Press. What's the backlash about?
Yeah, I mean, so I just want to explain what AP style is for people who don't know. It's Associated Press style, like you said. It's just a style guide that sets rules about what words and phrases reporters can and can't use.
Yeah.
For example, according to the AP style guide, reporters should refer to what's happening in the Middle East right now as the Israel-Hamas war, which is a term that many people think is misleading.
It's a tough issue to navigate. So was this the case elsewhere too?
Yeah, so I also talked to a student reporter at UC Berkeley's student newspaper, the Daily Californian, or the Daily Cal.
I'm Kiana Sezawar Kishavaz. I'm a freshman at Cal. I'm 19.
Kiana's been a reporter at the Daily Cal for about 2 semesters, and she spent a ton of time reporting on the Gaza encampment there.
We did a 24-hour coverage of the camp, and so that's 24 hours. And then, of course, writing the article, editing it, and going to classes. I mean, I didn't sleep for like 39 hours at one point.
But again, even they didn't have full access. They wrote in their article that, quote, organizers instructed campers not to speak to journalists in order to prevent inaccurate or outdated information from spreading. The Daily Cal, like GGX, also follows the AP style guide. Kiana, like Karen, says that this makes it harder for her to do her job.
People who are at the front line of a national movement don't want to interview with us.
It's especially frustrating because, according to Kiana, because the Daily Cal is a student news source, they actually aren't required to follow the AP style guide in the same way publications with larger stakeholders might be. She told me that the senior editorial board actually votes every year on whether or not to follow the guide. And her frustration with this decision that they've made over and over and over again actually led to her resigning. Just 2 days before our interview, she turned in a letter of resignation.
Oh, wow. What did she say in the letter?
It's really long. And so I'm going to provide a link to the letter on our website. I really want people to go and read the whole thing, but I'll read a part of it right now that really stood out to me. So long as we follow a style guide that obfuscates the events currently relevant to these communities, I cannot do so accurately. I cannot do my job as a journalist.
So this is a generation of journalists that are really redefining what it means to be a journalist, or actually they're like kind of defining it on their own terms. So Ren, what's next?
You mean for the encampments? Things are happening on a case-by-case basis. The UCSF camp I played tape from at the beginning is gone now. The university refused to negotiate with them. SF State has agreed to review their investment policy, and the camp there has gotten smaller, but there are still people camping out.
Mm-hmm.
UC Berkeley also agreed to review their investment policy, and the camp was packed up.
Mm.
We'll see what happens in the coming months. But I just want to say it's been a real privilege to work alongside these student journalists and to watch this generation of organizers redefine what good journalism is.
Well, thank you, Ren.
Thank you, Hannah.
Ren is our emergency and disaster preparedness reporter. You can find more of his work at kalw.org/crosscurrents. You're listening to Cross Currents from KALW News. I'm Hannah Baba. Research shows that adults of Asian American and Pacific Islander descent seek mental health services much less than any other demographic group in the country. And seniors in those AAPI communities are especially vulnerable. With families out all day, they can often experience loneliness, anxiety from anti-Asian hate crimes, and language barriers to accessing mental health services. But AAPI communities are incredibly diverse, so there's no one-size-fits-all solution for this. What seems to be working is community-led, culturally appropriate programs that meet seniors where they're at and recognize their diverse needs. I spoke with clinical psychologist Dr. Helen Hsu. She's the author of The Healing Trauma Workbook for Asian Americans. In it, she unravels some of the challenges facing older people from these communities and what's working to help them. Tell me the basics of why you think we should be talking about AAPI seniors and the risk of mental health issues.
I think the culturally responsive care that we know now helps all people for their health, their mental health. It's a big issue among Asian American, Native Hawaiian, Pacific Islander communities because we have so few culturally tailored resources. This is a very large aging population. AANHPIs have higher numbers of multi-generational households. So elders living with maybe a nuclear family, but we have very few services.
What are some of the factors that can contribute to mental health issues in AAPI senior communities?
The loneliness and isolation, the lack of transportation options. If you can't drive, a lot of our home countries, you didn't need to drive. You had a place to go, you could walk to or take a bus. So here you might find yourself in a huge city or in a distant suburb. Nobody speaks your language, offers your food. You don't have a place to go. So there's isolation, and there's also what every person really craves is a sense of purpose, some motivation. And so, yes, losing that role as an elder in the community, maybe not working anymore or not having skills that are seen as valuable.
Can you talk about the stigma attached to talking about mental illness even? Even if there was a provider, that's an issue.
There is a tendency in a lot of our heritage countries to view health as a holistic thing. And so it's okay to talk about maybe being out of balance, about taking care of your mind and body. But as soon as you say the word mental health or mental illness or diagnosis, sometimes there's that real stigma of you're saying something is permanently wrong with me, or there's something wrong with my family, or I've never heard about this because we don't talk about it in our culture. So I have this misconception that somebody is either in the hospital, disabled, or normal, with no in between. And of course, the reality is most of us are somewhere in between all the time. But there's a real fear of losing face, of someone thinking something's wrong with me, something's wrong with our family.
I want to talk about this UCLA Center for Health Policy Research report that talked about culturally competent services. They said without community-specific knowledge of culture, traditions, and values, mental health professionals can misdiagnose or completely discount the signs of mental health concerns because individual patient systems of beliefs and values have a significant influence on their, like, even their willingness to engage. Why is this even important?
It's absolutely life-changing important, right? Whether or not someone gets care and whether they get care in time could be the difference of severity, even life and death. And so cultural responsiveness training, engaging the community and community experts is fundamental to how we do that. And it's not that difficult, actually. Sometimes I feel like systems will say, well, that's just too hard. But there are models that do already exist. Like you mentioned, that there were models already in place at San Francisco General, for example. I often, when I teach, talk about in the Central Valley of California, there was a program that integrated Hmong shamans into the hospital. So the hospital staff could learn about what kind of spiritual and cultural practices helped people feel better and heal better. And the shamans themselves learned about this is what they do at the hospital and how it works, and we can share that with our community, which genders more trust. Otherwise, they would just never go, or they would just try to go home as soon as possible against medical advice. And Waianae Coast Comprehensive Health Center on Oahu has, you know, hospitals, dentists, mental health professionals. They also have a Kupuna Elder Council that gives advisement. They have traditional Lomi Lomi massage. They have a healing garden, right? And so this brings people in a way that, again, feels non-stigmatizing, supportive, healing.
So your new book, The Healing Trauma Workbook for Asian Americans, in it you say it blends contemporary psychology with ancient mind-body approaches to help you build resilience in the face of racism, overcoming trauma and internalized oppression, reclaim your mental health, celebrate your heritage. Can you explain a little more and give us some examples of this approach?
In doing psychological work for about 20 years now, what I found was that we have some pretty good tools, but Asian American, Native Hawaiian, Pacifica people's clients would say, well, this is pretty good and it's a little bit helpful, but none of the materials currently in existence talk about the intergenerational trauma that my family has endured, maybe the daily microaggressions and racism I'm experiencing, the impact this has on my self-image and my identity. Or I have a Western therapist suggesting things to me that are actually against my values, is something that happens, unfortunately, often that a well-intentioned Western individual therapist doesn't understand that your client has very deep values that are maybe different and something should be approached in another way. And that our heritage cultures have long had practices which help support mind and body health. So Tai Chi and Qigong and yoga and drumming circles and storytelling circles, elder consults, and of course, prayer, rituals, chants. These have all existed for thousands of years and have been helpful. And of course, now Western research is catching up. Like, hey, singing really helps depression. Well, yes, we've known that. You know, hey, yoga or Tai Chi is like helpful. Like, well, yes, we've known that, even if we use different language for it.
We've been doing it.
Mm-hmm.
Meditation. Yes. When meditation came out, well, not came out, but, you know,
the research, yeah.
The trend, meditation is like, people have been doing this for thousands of years and you're just catching up. Yes.
And as you said, now the research is discovering, hey, wow, meditation changes brainwaves. Hey, you know, dance actually improves moods. Art actually helps trauma victims integrate and organize their experiences. So these are all wonderful things that I think American-style, capitalistic, siloed medicine haven't quite figured out yet. How do we integrate this in the care?
Mm. So if somebody's listening to this now and is thinking about their mother, their father, they're not well, and they want to help them, what can they do? What do you advise them?
I mean, speaking with elders is its own thing, but often I really normalize, like, hey, there are things we can do proactively to help you be healthier. in mind and body. And a lot of our elders do think about health as a mind, body, spirit, and community experience. So what are things that we could do ideally often with elders if you can find community that's the best place? A community center or family gatherings to normalize, to give examples, finding language accessible resources and supports. I work with a lot of college and graduate students, and often we're looking up information, say in their parents' native language, about mental health and mental well-being, and we prepare that, and they actually share that with their parents. Because for bicultural, multicultural people and families, we often even struggle with the fact that within the same family, we don't quite have the language to talk about these things.
Right. So, there's a reverence there, right? Mm-hmm. Like, am I going to my father and tell him something's wrong with him? In many cultures, that can't even happen.
Absolutely. You know, I'm at an age now where a lot of us are trying to make very difficult decisions about elder care and safety. And yes, you can't go to your respected elder and say, you need a neuropsych eval. I think you're getting dementia. I mean, there's a grief in even having to say that or realize that. And people need support going through that. But also, that's never going to go well with your elder. But can you talk about, here's some screening tests. I really care about you. I want you to do this. It's something very normal that everyone at this age does, just to make sure we protect your well-being as long as possible. So the focus is not on, let's diagnose you with dementia. The focus is on, if you get a clear exam, that's so great. We'll be so happy. And if there's a cause for concern, then we'll know and we'll start doing things to protect your, you know, strong mind as long as we can. But what we have now is that sometimes not being able to have these conversations, not getting the screening, means people get much, much sicker than they need to be. And maybe we could have had some treatment that would have slowed the dementia, but we never got it. The growing body of research work, which confirms and validates that these ancient healing techniques that people have been doing all over the world for generations do have efficacy, is very promising. And how can we apply that? And of course, have things evolve for modern life. And there are very, very slowly, but there are more clinicians of diverse backgrounds and experiences who are able to bring more of that into our communities. One good example of a promising program is the very tiny, but minority fellowship program that the American Psychological Association has. And that's an example of a program that recruits, encourages, partially funds, and gives a lot of professional training and mentors to historically marginalized or underrepresented young people who want to get into healthcare. And I feel hopeful.
That's Dr. Helen Su. She's the author of the Healing Trauma Workbook for Asian Americans. For Cross Currents, I'm Hannah Baba.